Are you struggling with fear, depression, or anxiety? Are you in search of meaning and purpose? Would you like help navigating your current life circumstances? Tarot can help. Tarot is a powerful tool for healing, introspection, and spiritual awakening. The Esoteric Toolkit is a synthesis of ancient wisdom and modern science. It consists of tarot, numerology, astrology, and the Hermetic principles in conjunction with the modern science of consciousness. The revelation and application of this knowledge gives you the tools you need to help master your life, organize your mind, and overcome depression, fear, and anxiety. Learn to manifest your dreams and come into alignment with your highest self and the universe. Book your private one-on-one tarot reading today. Click the link in the description or go to www.theorderofchaosmagic.com. You can also find monthly tarot packages, a private Discord community featuring shadow work, and Mercury retrograde support groups, and much more by becoming a patron at patreon.com/theorderofchaos.
Welcome back to the Order of Chaos podcast. My name is Sonray, and today my guest is Sarah Landry. Sarah is a survivor of the Nithyananda cult and has been a prominent voice speaking out against the atrocities happening there. And that's what we're going to talk about today on the show. Real quick, before we get started, if you would like to get a private tarot reading with me, you can do so at www.theorderofchaosmagic.com. Links will be in description. And if you want to support the show, do consider becoming a patron. You get the unedited version of this show a few days before it's released on YouTube and access to blogs and some other fun perks. So with all that said, Sarah, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I've been excited to do this for a long time. A few years back, I was really closely following your story and thinking like, holy crap, I can't believe this kind of thing still happens and that it's happening on such a large scale. I was really blown away by it. And then I've kind of lost track of what happened because I know that Nithyananda fled to India. And at that point, it's been really difficult to keep track of what's happening. So yeah, really excited to talk to you. This is a topic I'm quite passionate about, speaking out against guru culture. And that's not to say that every spiritual teacher or, you know, person you look up to who you may consider a guru is necessarily bad or evil, but there's a lot of things about this culture that are predatory. And I want to talk about that stuff.
Great.
So thank you for being here.
My pleasure. You know, and that's one of my passions too, because you go in to listen to one of these individuals and on the surface level, everything they're saying might be good, but how you described it as being predatory in nature, that's something a lot of people don't expect to encounter in a quote unquote spiritual environment. And lots of red flags we can talk about, but the guru culture in general, I think, is something that at the heart of Hinduism or Sanatana Dharma, the connection between a guru and a chela is something considered very sacred and very deep. It's almost like the connection between a child and the parent. But a lot of the actual Hindu scriptures describe something like a wolf in sheep's clothing. Like there are warning signs even given scripturally in the Guru Gita and in the Agamas that describe the difference between a well-intentioned person who's had a spiritual revelation, who can help you get the same, and somebody who sees a business opportunity, how to get rich or how to feed like a vampire off the energy of devotion from people or how to get favors from people. And we don't really hear about that much because these aren't scriptures that are really available in English translations or popularized. So, you know, people who are familiar with these sacred Sanskrit texts might be in a better position to know who to trust and who not to trust than those of us who assume anybody in a saffron robe must be a pure celibate holy person.
Yeah, and like I'm not going to spend the next 2 hours, because we could, talking about the severely racist implications of that kind of thinking. But that's something that really goes into it as well. And, you know, especially for us here in North America, who don't have a really rich spiritual life necessarily as an everyday part of our culture, like some other countries do, when we have like a spiritual awakening experience, it's so exciting and new. And especially like for me, it was like entirely life-changing. Like completely life-changing for the better in a million ways. And so you have a lot of positive energy about it. And you're like, yeah, this is such a good thing. And so it can become so easy to fall into one of these traps. Like for me personally, and not to say that this is like a total trap, but like, you know, I went from studying occultism in a very sort of traditional way to like really getting into new age stuff. And some of that, I started to realize like, there's a lot of narcissism in here. It is not jiving with what the supposed message is. And so when I started to really feel how much of that was present, I backed way out and got back to a more traditional path, and that's what I'm on now, and much happier that way. But I recognized in that space something's wrong here. There's a ego trap that exists here that is deep, and it is dangerous. And it happens in all different types of spirituality. So I'm going to ask you a two-part question, and I'm just going to let you speak for a while because it's going to be kind of a doozy. Can you, as quickly as you can, for my audience who might not know about you, summarize your experience with Nithyananda? And then after that, tell us what's happened since he fled.
Sure. Yeah, that is a doozy. That's 2 hours. But I'll try to narrow it down. So I was living in Vancouver in 2009 when I found him. And at that time, I definitely described myself as a seeker. I was working as a professional tarot reader at the Tarot Room in Vancouver. And I had this goal to get enlightened so that I could be sure that whatever messages came through my readings would serve the highest good of my clients. And so I wanted it not only for the experience and the bliss and the cosmic consciousness, but also really to better my career. And at that time, I'd already gone to see different Buddhist teachers and local Vancouver meditation centers and enjoyed it, but nothing really clicked until I discovered this fraud who calls himself Nithyananda. And I feel like there was a specific formula that caught me up in it and made me feel like that's what I was looking for. And that's that as soon as I stepped into his center on 111 West Broadway, my, you know, repeat number believing magical thinking brain thought, that's a sign, like 111, I'm meant to be here. And the lady who opened the door and welcomed me in told me something really mystical, like they were about to start the guided meditation, but she heard his voice tell her, there's a girl at the door, go let her in. So I immediately let my guard down and felt like I'm meant to be in this place. And the meditation we did was something he plagiarized from Osho. It was a dynamic meditation. And I felt a Kundalini activation. I had visions of Hindu gods that felt very, very real to me. And just like you said, your first real spiritual awakening, it's life-changing in a good way. I don't discount the veracity of those experiences I had, but I do now understand in retrospect, the faulty attribution made me give him credit for what I experienced. And it's like, I'd been meditating every day for a year leading up to this, seeking enlightenment, praying for enlightenment, chanting in Sanskrit, binge watching YouTube videos about Hinduism. So I was already ripe for that kind of an experience. And the particular meditation technique he took from Osho catalyzes something like that. So the people in that center convinced me I had that experience because Swamiji blessed me to. And they upsold me to a $200 program in which he was actually in Vancouver. So it was a full day of meditations followed by a darshan from him, which is where he touches you and tells you that now he's planted the seed of enlightenment through his physical touch. It's something, you know, rampant in guru culture, like Amma hugs you and now you're hers, or he touches you, now your third eye is open.
It's a great way for a lot of these people to try to get away with committing sexual assault also.
Absolutely. That's the real seed that's planted. Yeah. And yeah, right. Like the very first time I ever met him physically that day, it was September 23rd, 2009. As soon as I went up for darshan, what he did for everybody else was like put his hand on their forehead, bless them. For me, he grabbed me into a really long hug and said, I love you. And that's something that I take really seriously. You don't say those words to somebody unless you've already developed a relationship, a connection. It's family or a close friend or a partner. And I trusted him because I didn't believe somebody could be so manipulative as to use the guise of spirituality or love to manipulate somebody else. And just like any MLM, pyramid scheme, cult, the $200 program was essentially a sales pitch we paid for the $6,000 program in India. And so I left that night, and my only goal, my only effort was to raise the funds to get to India, which I managed to do. And then once you're there in India, that wickedly expensive program is just a brainwashing machine. Like every day followed a rigid structure. Wake up at 4 a.m. First you do yoga, then you do puja, which is worshiping the man. Then he gives you his discourse. And, you know, since leaving, I've studied a lot about the psychology of mind control. And there are specific ingredients that will make somebody susceptible to whatever lie you tell them, such as sleep deprivation, malnourishment, intense physical activity, followed by a really calm, quiet, monotonous speaking voice. Like he hypnotized us. And after that program, a lot of people stayed back to become what were called ashramites, to live there as permanent volunteers. And I was lucky that I still had a lease on an apartment. I still had reasons to go back to Vancouver, or I would have stayed back too. Fast forward a little bit for the sake of time. I went back for another program in 2010 after his scandal broke out where a sex tape of him was leaked to Indian media. He lost a lot of devotees. I wasn't smart enough to drop ship, or I was brainwashed enough not to drop ship. He invited back whoever had stayed with him through that scandal for a free program. And that program, rather than focusing on yoga and meditation, which we were promised, it was basically free labor. He had some people building new infrastructure in the campus. He had others going through articles and translating them to make it look like the media is abusing him. The team that I was put on was called the social media team. So we had to build up a Facebook presence for him and try to recruit people. And he had us doing cold calls. There were lists of phone numbers. Anybody who had ever signed up for his online meditation, we had to phone them and ask them, you know, why haven't you done Inner Awakening yet? Why don't you come to the next program? And there was no gratitude for any of our work. And I think that's another red flag. If a group pulls you in and demands your volunteer time, demands you do something for them, and at the end, rather than thank you, they berate you for not doing enough, that's a cult. And that's what happened to us. But because we had all been told, In a setting where everyone around you reinforces the false belief that he's an incarnation of God, we didn't feel like we were being used and abused. We felt like we were being blessed to be given the privilege to be a part of his growing community. And I came back to Canada, but in 2015, went back yet again for another $6,000 Inner Awakening program. And my mother came with me that second time. And that's when I really got love bombed, which is a word they use in the cult community for when when a group really wants to recruit a very specific person, they'll roll out the red carpet and make that person feel special and just shower you with praise to the point where you feel addicted to that energy they're giving you. You feel so good that you just want that forever. And he did that to me. Like on the first day he appeared in the hall, he made a bunch of people move back away from him from the front row, saying like, you're not doing enough for my Sangha. You're not doing enough. You're not contributing enough. And I was sitting in the farthest back row because I wasn't officially a member of his hierarchy. And he called for me to sit right at his feet, which is like the place of privilege. And so I was on cloud nine. I felt like this incarnation of Shiva is giving me all kinds of special treatment. And he told everyone the reason he did that was that I had maintained a strong devotion to him throughout all the abuse that he endured, and he appreciated that. And it was true, I had. So at the end of that program, I signed up to be an Adi Navasi, which is their updated word for ashramite, and decided to take the vow of sannyas, which is like their monastic initiation. Went back for the next Kumbh Mela, which is like a huge Hindu spiritual gathering that takes place every 4 years. And during that Kumbh Mela, he gave me the kavi, like the orange cloth. And at that point, it's like the love bombing or the honeymoon phase ended. And I discovered what it's really like to live in his organization, which is nothing but abuse. It's constant mind games, bullying, pressure, verbal assault. They would have us do things like sit in a group of people and confess all the times you've had doubt about the guru. And then they would give you harsh verbal lashings for any time you've doubted him. They would have you confess, for example, if you were late for yoga, if you missed one of the pujas, the worship ceremonies, you know, if you maintained a connection with a friend who's against the group, all of those things were considered bad. And it's funny because having grown up Catholic and rejected organized religion, I always believed myself to be a free thinker and somebody who won't go along with a group like that. And suddenly I found myself in an environment even more controlling than Catholicism had been. And one thing that appealed to me about Sanatana Dharma is that there's no such thing as sin. There's only action. There's dharma. There's karma. There's what you align yourself to, what you create in life. That's what I love. And yet this cult was using double speak and, you know, mind bending sort of intellectual deconstructions of those concepts to make us believe dharma is obedience to the guru. Karma is anything that pulls you away from him. And so rather than living the true Vedic principles, we were living purely indoctrinated life of brainwashing. And that went on for me until 2018, when at that point he had already started sexually abusing me and convincing me that I was the only one. He told me I was an incarnation of Shakti and he's Shiva. And it was ridiculous, but when your mind is mush because of all the craziness of the lifestyle, you believe crazy things. And yeah, he fled India because of a rape case filed against him by a lady named Arti Rao, who was one of his initial victims. And after he fled, I was sent to Toronto. And you'll find this funny, I'm sure, as an Ontarian, that the mission I was given in Toronto was to get an appointment with Trudeau and use the political connection to get him political asylum in Canada. He wanted to be completely protected by the government of Canada. He wanted a contract stating he will never be extradited to India. He wanted all kinds of crazy things. And what I found so funny about this was that I told him, in order for me to make a connection with Prime Minister Trudeau, send me to Ottawa. He's not based in Toronto. He's based in Canada's capital. So it's like one of his inner circle members must have Googled what's the biggest city there or something. Mm-hmm. And they don't even know where to send their disciples. But while I was in Toronto, there were two kids staying in the house along with all of us monastic disciples. And they were 12 and 13 years old. The girl turned 13 while there. The boy was 13. Their job was that they were supposed to demonstrate powers of the third eye to any VIPs who might show up at the temple or any politicians we were able to reach out to. And one night, those kids came to see me and one of the other ladies who was staying in the house. And they cried. The little girl put her head on my lap. She started to cry. And I asked her what was wrong. And she said, I can only tell you if you have approval from Swamiji to talk with Gurukul kids. Like, do you have that approval? And I did have approval to talk to Gurukul kids. So I told her yes. And she said, well, then why I'm crying is that I still feel scared to go back because of the December 31st beatings. And I asked her, what is that? I've never heard of these December 31st beatings. And she said, on the morning of December 31st, the lady who ran the residential school within the ashram had come into the dorms where the kids were sleeping, pulled them all out of bed and forced them to beat each other. And that her own kids, she beat herself, but the other kids, the senior kids, had to beat the junior kids and then each other. And she said it was so painful because they were told by her, beat until they either bleed or cry. She had to see blood or tears or else it didn't count.
Oh my God.
And it was horrific because we were all told that this Gurukul runs under the principle of ahimsa, which is the Sanskrit word for nonviolence. And the lie we'd all been told is that the teachers don't even yell at the kids because yelling is a form of verbal violence. And so to find out not only do they get yelled at, but they also get beaten was for me the last straw. Like that's what kind of snapped me out of it. From that moment, it was 1 week before I actually escaped completely. I took a little bit of time to acquire regular clothes again. Like all I had were orange saris. So I didn't want to leave unless I had like jeans and a t-shirt. So I found a way to get those from one of the local devotees. I booked myself a plane ticket. I made the arrangements. I planned it out so that I could be the last one in the house after all the other people go to the temple in the morning so that nobody would try to stop me from getting in the cab and that none of them would see me in jeans and a t-shirt. And I just made a run for it and got out. And then after that, it was a year before I had the guts to speak publicly, because in the past, anyone who has spoken out against this cult has been buried in false accusations and litigation. So it's like if you follow the Nexium case, they had the Bronfman heiresses who would hire lawyers to go after defectors or whistleblowers. The Nityananda cult has people who do the same thing. And so I was really scared that they're going to come after me if I speak out. And I credit it to my mom for giving me the courage to go public, because I told her about the Gurukul beatings and about the sexual abuse. And I told her, I really feel like I have to say something, because if I don't, nobody will. And these kids confided in me, and I don't take that lightly. I feel like there was a reason they trusted me with that information, even though they had been told it's Guru Droha or a crime against that fraud to tell anybody about the beatings. And I told my mom, like, she asked me, what's the worst case scenario if you speak out and if you go public? And I told her I could go into permanent debt because they sue me for slander, which they've done to people, or I could get thrown into jail if they have somebody falsely accuse me of rape, which is their MO. Anybody who goes against them, somebody accuses that person of rape. And my mom asked me, like, is that something that you're willing to endure in order to help the kids? And it was a no-brainer. Like, yeah, if there's a possibility to get kids out of this deeply destructive, violent, abusive situation, I'd be willing to sacrifice that. And so I went public. They definitely did a character assault against me. They accused me of trying to poison the fraud. They called me an assassin. I've seen some of the videos.
It's ridiculous.
Right.
They called you a CIA asset at one point, right? Yeah. And, you know, it's funny because that's just such another go-to for these kinds of crazy people. He's a CIA asset. Yeah, you're a rapist. They're going to say every nasty thing they can possibly think about you. And it sounds silly. I mean, when I saw it, now I was already sort of aware of your case, but I know that if I had never seen you before, never seen a video, and I saw that video, I'd be like, this sounds like bullshit to me.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it's over dramatic and they're clearly acting.
Absolutely. Like they accused me of keeping a sex slave and forcing him to do it 10 times a day. They accused me of working for the Vatican to try to bring down Hinduism. And like my counter to that is that if I was a Vatican agent, I wouldn't have had the Trishul tattooed permanently on my hand. Like a Vatican person would think of that as a pitchfork, not as the sacred symbol of Shiva. It's just,
of course. Though when you're that deep into conspiratorial thinking, any evidence to the contrary just becomes evidence to further your case because you're like, oh, you got that to make us think that you would never do. You know what I mean? It's that kind of thinking. It's one of the dangers. And then that's another thing. I mean, we could do a whole other episode on that when it gets into the dangers of conspiracy theories when it comes to spirituality. I mean, these things blend together in a way that people don't realize what they're getting themselves into.
It's serious.
And it's, you know, my mission, at least with my channel and you know, whatever these things I'm doing, is just to help people know themselves a little bit better, because it helped me so much. Spirituality helped me so much that I felt immediately that I need to, in a non-preachy way, try to share it with as many people as I can, just because it's exciting to me, because I'd spent the vast majority of my life being severely depressed, and suddenly I wasn't. I'm like, okay, this is a miracle. Oh. This is a miracle I need to share with people. But that's not what's going on with people like Nithyananda. They want your money and your devotion. That's what they want. They want you to worship them. They want your cash. And they will do anything and say anything to get it. And what's crazy to me is how effective it is.
Yeah.
Because this is a formula that, I mean, Scientology, Nithyananda, Nixium, I mean, the list goes on and on and on. There's so many cults all using these same tactics, and they really work on people. And because they're blending these sort of this mysticism and spirituality, which can be so beneficial to you, they're blending it with their poison. It's despicable, and it's so anti-spiritual. Because you end up working towards everything that is anti-spiritual and is not, it's not enlightenment. It's your descent into chaos and madness.
Exactly.
You know, and that's what they do to you.
And they'll convince you that anything innately good in you is a character defect. Like the first time I heard Nitti, as we refer to him, not a term of endearment, but a derogatory abbreviation of his name. The first time I heard him really yell at somebody, and it was frightening. Like he growled, he bared his teeth, he called them Naye, which is Tamil for dog. And like as an animal rights activist, I hate it when people use the name of an animal as a derogatory term, but he broke or crossed so many lines for me in that moment, yelling at somebody, growling at somebody, becoming angry and agitated, which to me is not spiritual. I feel that being able to talk to somebody in a space of love and openness and mutual respect, even if they've done something to upset you, coming to terms that you can both agree on, that's the spiritual solution. Especially a disciple who gave up her millions of dollars and left her husband to follow him. He yelled at somebody like that. And I told one of my friends, I didn't like that. I didn't like that side of him. And I said, this isn't the Swamiji I thought I was following. And that got reported up the structure to him. Because just like in Scientology, everyone has to do reports on everybody else. If somebody goes against the guru, you have to tell. It's like a tattletale culture. And
that
so
is so insane and psychologically damaging, because they strip you of your right to any kind of privacy.
Yeah.
Nobody can survive that. Like it'll break your brain. And that's of course what they're trying to do. They're trying to break your brain. That's the whole point.
Literally, yes. He would literally tell us in those exact words, I'm breaking your brain because your brain is flawed. He would say, I'm not brainwashing you, I'm washing your brain. All kinds of doublespeak. But I remember like that night there was an ashramites gathering. And in front of everybody, he yelled at me and said, like, Swarupa Priya, your Canadian politeness is stupid. And that, you know, being nice is not spiritual. Being ferocious is spiritual. I yell at people to break their patterns. And from then on, it's like he made it his mission to turn me into that. He would instruct me to yell at people. He would instruct me, for example, before the morning yoga, he gave me the job of wake up everyone in the ladies' dorm and force them to come. If they're sick, his exact words were drag them by their hair to the yoga hall, no exemptions, everyone has to be there. And obviously I never actually hit anybody or dragged anybody by their hair. So then I would get yelled at and punished for people missing the yoga because I was told get them there by any means necessary. And so it was really messed up where he would raise some of us to the position of leadership within the organization. Like he made me a Mahant, which is second from the top of that pyramid. So to an outside eye, it would have looked like I was a higher up in the cult, but he would feed specific bits of information to specific people. So I didn't know about the illegal activities or the violence or the fact that he was grooming kids for sex or demanding nude photos from everyone. Oh yeah. I mean, I've only revealed half of the crap that went on there in YouTube videos because I'd rather get an FBI agent investigating it than, you know, clickbait for YouTube. But he was doing things on the same level as Keith Raniere and even worse, if you can believe it. Like he was Keith Raniere abused women and underage girls. Nitti abused women, underage girls, men, and underage boys. So nobody was safe from his sexual predatory impulses. Like everyone was targeted in that cult. And I'm starting to open up more about it now because a lot of the parents were able to block out what I've said about the beatings because they've accepted that. They've been fed the lie that their kids are yoga purushas or like incarnations of yogis and that beatings hurt them. Yeah.
Sorry, I'm a father and that I just can't even.
I'm sorry. I won't go too far into that, but.
No. I mean, it's just, I mean, I cannot believe those parents. I mean, I understand that they're brainwashed, but.
Yeah.
No brainwashing should allow you to witness your child being hurt or understand or know that they're being hurt and just be like, it's fine.
Absolutely. I mean, the father of the girl who cried on my lap, I sent him a private message before I went public and said, you should know it was your daughter who told me this. And he blocked me. And then he did a Facebook Live video saying Sarah Landry abused my daughter by talking to her without my permission.
Oh my gosh.
So these parents are brainwashed. And as far as I'm concerned, they are also criminally negligent.
No,
and they need to
horrifying.
Know if you have a son or a daughter in that cult, break their privacy, go into their Facebook Messenger, look at their chat history with Nityananda, at least, you know, one out of every two will be sexting with him, will be sending him nude photos, will be obedient to him in a very sick, perverse way. It's not a matter of whether or not he's doing it. It's a matter of how many kids he's doing it with. And I know this for a fact. I have had children send me screenshots of their messages with him. So it's not something that I'm speculating. It's not a rumor. It is confirmed. I've spoken to at least four underage kids who were underage when he started doing this with them. And I've heard from other adults who left the organization who have had other kids confide in them. It's happening. And a lot of parents, I feel like they fall into the trap of saying stupid things like, well, if my child is happy, I don't want to get involved. I don't want to come in the way of my kid and their spiritual path. But this is not the same. This isn't like, you know, you catch your kid straying from the religion they were brought up with, and you decide to give them that freedom to explore. This is very different. This is like you catch your kid with a predator. It's your responsibility to put an end to it. Absolutely. And I also feel really proud of some of the other victims or survivors of that cult who have come forward, like Jordan Lozada. He is the only male abuse victim of this guru who has had the courage to go public and to face the potential shame that comes along with that. Very, very few people have been willing to speak out publicly because they know the cult is going to falsely accuse them of something, or they know people are going to ask them stupid questions like, why did you let this happen to you? Or, weren't you an adult when this happened? So it was your free will. And I feel like we have to break the stigma.
That argument is one of the real fucking problem in the spiritual community. Yeah. That kind of thinking, it is disgusting. Like, don't get me wrong, okay? I have a lot of beliefs that other people think are silly. I 100%, 1000% firmly believe in astrology. And I believe that we plan, to an extent, plan our lives before we're born. And that includes some horrible things.
Yeah.
But there's right and there's wrong here in the 3D and the material realm where we live now. There's right and there's wrong, and you have to act on what's right if you want to do what's right. And, you know, there's really no two ways around it. And to say, oh, it's your fault because this is your karma, or this is your soul's contract, or any of that such bullshit. Fuck you to the fucking center of the universe. Like, get just...
I know.
That's some bullshit.
Yeah. Absolutely. And you know, the other bullshit, like, why didn't you say no? Why didn't you tell him to stop? Well, these are people who had spent years being indoctrinating into believing he is a faultless, perfect incarnation, and surrounded by a community that reinforces that, and also shown the example of what happens to the people who say no. If you say no, you get sent to do hard manual labor in one of the branch campuses. You get berated by everybody. You get put into what's called prayaschitta, where you're not allowed to wear the sari or the dhoti. You have to put on what looks like prisoner pajamas, and you're not allowed to talk to anybody. And life becomes an even deeper level of torture than it already is for everybody who's there. So it's not like, you know, somebody makes a pass at you and you're not interested and you say no and there you go, you're fine. It's more like a bully boss makes a pass at you and say no, and now you're fired, you're demoted. Everybody cuts you off from the community. You become a prisoner there. And it's very akin to what in Scientology, I forget the technical term, but Chris Shelton and Ron Miscavige both drew a parallel when I told them about this, that they have a thing where people have to put on all black and do manual labor and not talk to anybody. So we were being told this is how it works in Hinduism, but it's not that. This is how it works in a cult.
In any cult. Yeah. And you can turn any spiritual belief, any spiritual practice, any religion into a cult. Yeah. It's just by following these same steps, because they all use the same tricks. And the one that I think you know, is like the number one red flag that anybody should be looking out for is when some spiritual teacher claims to be a reincarnation of some god or some famous person, you know. And like, to be fair, okay, like I'm sort of a, I think he's silly, but I'm sort of a fan of Bashar, who's a channel, right?
Oh, yeah.
And he claims to be channeling this higher consciousness. But the thing is, he's not trying to take anything from you. He's not trying to give you bad advice. He even says, like, I understand this is silly, you know, like it's great and it's fun and it's funny. I take it all with a grain of salt, of course, because for someone as deeply involved in magic and astrology as I am, I'm actually very skeptical of almost everything. Yeah. It's just, it's the way that I balance myself out, you know. Mm-hmm. But then there are these people who say, I am very important. I'm the reincarnation of a god or of this famous person or a king or a queen, and I'm here to enlighten you and blah 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 blah, blah, you know. And they make you seem so small in comparison to them, right, which is the opposite of what I think any really good spiritual teacher does, because I think that a good spiritual teacher is incredibly humble, and if not incredibly humble, then like funny about it. Doesn't take themselves too seriously.
Well, it's like, you know? I love Bashar unashamedly, and I believe he is his higher self on another planet. I love that stuff.
I also really
love Abraham Hicks. And what I appreciate sometimes when Esther Hicks is channeling, Abraham will say, you know, it took this many years for Esther to get this, and these are the mistakes she made along the way. And to me, that's a sign of somebody who practices what they preach. Like, they're not afraid to tell you about times when they didn't get it or when they did it wrong and how they've aligned it to work for them. Right. Whereas frauds or narcissistic, manipulative, spiritual psychopaths will tell you, I've been perfect from the beginning. I was born without karma. I'm a spiritual catalyst. I'm the ultimate. I'm this, I'm that. And like you said, it makes you feel small compared to them, because they impose themselves as your only source of answers. And the last thing they want you to have is your own connection to spiritual wisdom.
Right. Or to understand your own true power. And that's why, and I'm going to get on, this is another thing that I cannot stand within the spiritual community, is the obsession with third eye superpowers. Now, again, I'm a professional tarot reader. I'm aware that your pineal gland is very important to your psychic abilities, but guess what? You are not going to walk through walls. Stop it.
Promise.
The videos of Nithyananda getting people to jump, you know, trying to get them to levitate, that is that level of brainwashing. I mean, it's impressive. I got to say, he's masterful at what he does.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is scary on a whole other level. And we can get to that. But I mean, it's ridiculous. And it's something that happens. It's one of those traps that when you discover spirituality, it does make you feel like perhaps I'm superhuman. That's one of the things that definitely gets you. And if you buy yourself a tarot deck and you experience what that can do to you, it's like, whoa, I have crazy psychic powers. Well, guess what? Yeah. We all do. You're not special. You've just discovered something new that's cool, right? But you are not going to levitate. You are absolutely not going to manifest, you know, pearls and gold into your hand. The videos of him blindfolding people and with the sand, it's just, people are so desperate to believe something. And I get that. Yeah. I totally do. But you have to stay grounded to be spiritual. Like, you cannot just let yourself float away into total nonsense land because there are predators out there. But not only are there predators here in the earth realm, I firmly believe that there are predatory spirits out there working through these people.
Absolutely. You know,
and they might not even be aware of it. A good example of that for me, and this is my own vendetta, I know a lot of people like this guy, but David Wilcock, I think he is on the verge of being one of these cult leaders, because he is clearly very addicted to the attention. He loves it. He's selling his products for a lot of money. People think he's so great. You can see it. You can see the change in him too over time, when he went from just wanting to share information to it being all about him and this crazy web of conspiracy theories surrounding him as the center of all of it, and him claiming to be the reincarnation of Edgar Cayce. Like, he's starting to check off the list of crazy cult leader. You know what I mean? And I wonder if he knows that it's happening. I really do. I wonder if there isn't something working through him that's insidious.
I've wondered that about a lot of these individuals. Like I've wondered that about the fraud who calls himself Nityananda. Like, similarly, you can see the devolution in him if you look at his teachings from, say, 2007, 8, and 9, compared to post-scandal, where he became very defensive, very aggressive in his approach. And he used to preach something kind of vanilla compared to the extremes that he's teaching now. Like, he would tell us things like, every religion and every teacher is a garden, and it's your job as a seeker to visit each garden and pick your favorite flowers and string your own mala of spirituality based on that.
I actually like that.
Me too.
That's what I've done.
Well, me too. And that's the Nityananda I fell for back in 2009. And then he slowly devolved into what he is now, where it's all about mystical powers. Like in 2009, he used to tell us, if you have a vision or an experience, keep it to yourself. That's for you. That's sacred. And telling it to other people could cause jealousy and comparison, or it might make them feel like they should have the same thing. It might start influencing other people's paths. He went from that to, if you have a vision or an experience, make a YouTube video about it. Tell everybody, make others come to get it. And, you know, earlier I was talking about how the Vedic scriptures actually outline what the red flags are. And in Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, the master Patanjali actually tells people, do not seek siddhis. Do not seek powers. Do not fall into the trap of going after levitation or telepathy, yes, or any ability. And he said, if they develop, if they happen as a result of your practice, enjoy them, but let them go. Don't tell anybody, don't brag about it. And so Nitti was very cunning in trying to reframe it as shaktis. And he would tell us, these aren't siddhis, these are shaktis. But there's no scriptural reference anywhere to mystical powers being called shaktis. So the same way he'll take an English word like completion and redefine it as like a cult vernacular, he'll even go so far as doing that to Sanskrit, rewriting definitions for Sanskrit terms and making everybody, even people who were born and raised Hindu, like I want to mention, the majority of his followers are not Westerners. It's just the majority of his followers who leave and speak out are Westerners. So it makes it look like this is a cult for Americans and Canadians.
But that's the impression I had, for sure, is that he had a cult of all people from America.
No, we were the minorities there. Oh. I was the only Western person who was allowed to sleep in his building, for example. He had a dorm, a men's dorm, a women's dorm, and an apartment complex. The apartments were for married couples within his cult. The dorms were for singles within his cult. And then he had what he called the palace. And it was a smaller, more luxury apartment complex. He lived on the top floor. And then the people who were his like close disciples lived in that building. I was the only Western person in that building. And He made it very clear. He even told me once in a meeting, and I love to share this now because he told me, don't share this to anybody outside. He said he does not want white disciples. He only wants wealthy NRI disciples. NRI means non-resident Indians. And I asked him, why NRIs? Why not, you know, all Indians or everybody, all people? And he said, Indians in India don't have enough money for him. And Western people who are not NRI Indian, they have money, but they can't be molded through the guru-disciple relationship because they weren't raised to believe guru is ultimate. But he said, NRIs have the best of both worlds. They have the wealth of a Westerner and the devotional spirit of an Indian. And he only wants those people.
Wow, so he really wants the people he can victimize maximally.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. He wants your money and your devotion. It's not either or. He wants both. And he also wants sexual favors. He wants control over your life. He wants to use you to recruit other people, just like any other cult leader. But yeah, he had a lot of Indian followers. And the reason is he claimed to be here to update the scriptures. And
to update them, of course, right? To change them, yeah. to fit his view.
Exactly. To always to serve him as the central God character. So it's very telling, like a red flag to look for. If there's a person who tells you that they are faultless, that they've never made a mistake, that whatever they say is right. If he accidentally called one of us by the wrong name, we were told that in a past life, we had an intermingling with that other person's essence. And that's why he confuses us. Like there's always an excuse for his mistakes. And that excuse always reframes it as not a mistake, but as a divine.
That's definitely another red flag. It's another thing that all these people do as part of the formula. A few episodes back, I did an episode on E.A. Kwedding, who's like, you know, within my own sort of sphere of left-hand path-ish, you know, occultism, chaos magic, and such. He's he's like, he calls himself a black magician and all this, but his sales pitch is like, I'm gonna give you godlike powers. It's like, oh my fucking God. People who fall for this, you know, I feel bad for them. It's just, but it's so ridiculous. And they all do the same thing where they're like, they don't. Well, okay, I'm gonna have to give Nithyananda a little bit of credit here, because he does really seem, and I've not read the Hindu scriptures. I'm no expert on any of this, but he seems to really have studied. Like, he seems to know what he's talking. He hasn't. No. He's just a bullshit artist. Oh my God.
He is, and I'm not exaggerating to try to insult the guy, but he is legitimately the laziest person I've ever met in my life. Teams of people in his organization who do this for him. There's a lady who was there when I was there named Kalikananda. That was the name he gave her. She was a Vedic scholar, a Sanskrit scholar. She went to university for it. She would sit morning till night, well, like early morning to next early morning, poring over scriptures, making translations. He would say, find a verse that validates this thing that I said. And it could be whatever bullshit he just spewed. Wow. And her task would be to find a Vedic scripture that correlates what he said. At the beginning of each of his discourses, for example, in 2015, when I took the Brahmacharya vow, he would start the morning by giving one of the verses from the Upanishads, and specifically the Isavasya Upanishad, which is like a divine scripture where the rishis and the munis would describe like the inner workings of the universe. And he made everyone believe that he had memorized these Upanishads. But in reality, Manyanatma Swami was sitting in the tech pit with a big screen TV where she would put the scripture up.
Because he talks for a long time. So I was wondering, he's looking at it, he's reading?
He's reading off a screen. He's ad-libbing the discourse, but the actual verse of the scripture and the translation are on the screen in front of him. He can't read Devanagari, which is the script Hindi and Sanskrit are written in. So it wasn't even the original form, like it was in English.
Okay, well then that's exactly what I was kind of getting at, is that these people, what they do is they, instead of studying, instead of learning, they claim that their information comes directly from source or from God or from, you know, whatever mystical blah, blah, blah that they want to, you know, and then they say, oh yeah, and I'm here to give new information, an update and all this stuff. And it's always the same shit, right? It's not only have they not studied, not only do they not know what they're talking about, not only are they making up a bunch of nonsense, they also just occasionally plagiarize from someone else to make it seem as though they know what they're talking about. Exactly. And then usually they will try to discredit what they plagiarize, saying like, you know, again, I'm going to update it. Here's the new version. Yeah. Here's the cooler, whatever, right?
So I can give you a specific example of that. He started teaching what he called AIRE, A-I-R-E, authenticity, integrity, responsibility, enriching. verbatim plagiarized from Landmark Forum. He sent two of his disciples there to study.
I'm sure I've heard that before.
They took notes. They came back with all the material they'd been given in Landmark. He rewrote it and made that into the 2012 and beyond Inner Awakening formula. He got sued by Landmark for plagiarizing, and then he set a team to search Sanskrit references that could correlate to these words. So he decided, okay, so authenticity is sampurti, and integrity is shraddha, and then authenticity is upayanam, enriching is apyayanam. And so he started to say, no, this isn't coming from Landmark. It's coming from the Agamas. It's Sampurti, Shraddha, Upayanam, and Apyayanam. And then he countersued Landmark for plagiarizing the Vedic scriptures.
Well, so as if he owns them.
It's a mind fuck. He plagiarizes them. They send him, I don't think they sued him. I think they sent him, what's it called? A cease and desist. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't teach this anymore. So he had his team of people scramble to find whatever close approximation in Sanskrit equals what he plagiarized. And then he sent them a cease and desist saying, no, I'm teaching what's in the authentic scriptures. I translated this. It's a coincidence that matches what you teach, or maybe you took it from the Agamas and didn't give it credit. And as a self-proclaimed embodiment of Hinduism, he claims to be the leader of all Hindus, 2 billion people. I don't know where he gets his numbers, but he claims to be the ultimate authority and the figurehead, the way the Pope is to Catholics or the Dalai Lama is to Tibetan Buddhists. He claims to be that of Hinduism. And with that, you know, self-styled God-man status, he goes after Landmark. And they drop it. They drop their cease and desist because he's, you know.
Because they know that they're doing the same thing. And they don't want this all to get to go too public. Yeah, because they're all doing the same shit. So they can't really call each other out on it without exposing one another.
No. It's just like when he called out Teal Swan. Like, one of his disciples sent him a thing that she's teaching the completion process. And so he called me and blasted me, berated me. Why didn't you know about this? Why weren't you aware that Teal Swan is stealing from me? And I said, I don't know who Teal Swan is. And he said, well, research it, find all her flaws, attack. And so he created this like weird YouTube drama where I had to attack her in a video, even though she hadn't even plagiarized him. I think they both plagiarized the same other source, which was, I forget what the name of the actual book was that she ripped off, but I found websites that showed passages she lifted, like a full paragraph, and copy pasted it. But it wasn't his teachings that she plagiarized, it was somebody else's. Anyway, it's just all of these people who claim to be divine and better than everybody else and incarnations of some great thing that you have to be in awe of. Like you said, they're all doing it. They're all stealing from each other, and they all have the same end game. It's like whoever has the most followers, the most money, the most popularity wins. And, you know, I think it's really great to see the way people who escaped Nexium have successfully gotten Keith Raniere imprisoned for multiple life sentences. I think that, to me, that shows that finally, the judiciary, the FBI, law enforcement are starting to understand the severity of people like Raniere, Epstein, Weinstein, Nityananda, using the positions of power they create for themselves to rape people who see them as the ultimate boss, you know? And to, I think, especially kids, like, the fact that I've come to find out that Nityananda has not only done this to adults, but that he's doing it to children. He's telling them things like, I am your father, but in bed, I'm your lover. That verbatim, that's one of the screenshots a kid sent me that he sent to her. Kids as young as 15, he was calling them into his room, and the Gurukul teacher was bringing them there and sitting outside and waiting. It's like, the way Epstein had Ghislaine Maxwell, Nityananda has Malprana Priya, and
oh, they all have someone to blame everything on in case shit hits the fan. Exactly. They all have a number two that's going to be the person who takes all the blame.
And I feel for them. I really do, because these are also brainwashed victims of his. Yeah. But some of us had an inner moral compass that no matter how brainwashed we were, we wouldn't beat people. We wouldn't beat kids. We wouldn't tolerate sexual violence against kids. And that's why I feel like he can tell which disciples are going to go along with his sickest level of abuse. And like, those are the people he puts as the head of the Gurukul school, or as the head of, you know, the entire ashram, like Ma Prana Priya. He knows which people have it in them to override whatever sense of responsibility they have for the safety and well-being of others. And he uses them worse than he uses anybody else. So I do have hope that as more people who experience that abuse see podcasts like yours or see the example set by Nexium, when they understand that he can't hurt them anymore and that it's safe for them to speak out, and that he can't accuse all of us of rape. He can't. Like, it's becoming obvious already. He called Lenin Karupan a rapist, and he was the first person to strongly support Arti Rao when she came out. So if he really was a rapist, why would he have gone to the extent of trying to help a rape victim? You know, if I really had committed any of the crimes they've accused me of committed, why would I have risked them outing me by going public about his abuse? And it's like, I think people are starting to wake up to understand, as much as he has bullied whistleblowers in the past and silenced whistleblowers in the past, he can't keep doing that forever because it's obvious. And I had one friend who left the cult after I went public, who told me that when I spoke out, a lot of people believed me, like even within his organization, because they knew that I wasn't the type of person to lie about violence against kids. And at that point, a lot of them left secretly, like without making any public statement. And that the few who stayed, when he started accusing me of being like a CIA agent or a Vatican agent or a member of the Illuminati or a rapist or a child beater, I mean, they did a PowerPoint presentation linking me to Beyonce and Jay-Z. And in all seriousness, I take it as a compliment. I wish that was true, but it's not, you know? But it's like, when he attacked me, they were even more convinced that I was telling the truth and that he's lying, because they knew that wasn't the case. And so I would really love it if more of his victims would stand up and speak out and, you know, follow the example of, you know, Toni Natale, who was Keith Raniere's ex-girlfriend who first blew the Nexium whistle, and Sarah Edmondson and Leah Remini and, you know, Ron Miscavige and Chris Shelton, like so many people who have left so many cults have endured character assassination in order to spread the truth for the greater good. And history will never look at the lies their ex-cults have spread against them. History will only look at the deceptions and the crimes of those cults and how they shed light on that. So I really hope, you know, that the maybe 10 to 15 of us who have spoken out, I'm not the only one, like other people, Jasmine Glow and, you know, Joanna Lasoka, Stephen Hodge, Jordan Lozada. I don't mean to give all of them names, like, but Ivana and Lainey, like a lot of us have spoken out, but even more who have left have stayed silent. And I
mean, that's a very small number. Only 15 of you have spoken out. I mean, and there are thousands of victims, right? I mean, people have died. Yeah. This is bonkers.
Yeah, people have died. Like a Canadian man died in 2008. He attended a program, asked for a refund, The next morning, his body was found on the ground beneath the third floor room where he was staying, and there was no investigation.
Wow.
He was taken to the ambulance by a member of the cult. And at the hospital, his death certificate said heart attack. But how could he have had a heart attack in the middle of the night while falling off a building? Like, it's very obvious he was killed. A girl named Sangeeta, she was a 24-year-old brahmacharini in 2012. She went home to her parents and complained that she was being beaten and she was being abused in the cult. She was contacted by the cult in her parents' home and told that she has to drop the kavi officially, which means return the orange robe to the guru. It's considered something that you do. If you leave the monastic path, you have to give back the robe with his blessing. She went back to do that. The next day, she died of what they claim was a heart attack. Wow. And to this day, her mother maintains that she was killed. She was poisoned. However, the cult, without permission from her parents, had her cremated before an autopsy was conducted. So,
oh my gosh.
Like, there have been four deaths within the organization, and they haven't been held accountable for any of them. And it's only a matter of time. And I think the reason they've gotten away with it for so long, like, I filed a complaint with the police in both Bidadi and Ramanagara. So those are the two jurisdictions in which his main ashram falls. So where my sexual abuse took place, it was in Bidadi. The Ramanagara police kind of oversee that whole community, surrounding area. Bidadi police, that specific location, both of them refused to file it as an FIR unless I physically appear there in person. So at the time, they ignored my complaint completely. I did everything by the book. I scanned my passport. I scanned my Indian visa. I had an affidavit signed by my lawyer to state that, you know, this really is me making these claims, making these accusations. I put names of other witnesses, phone numbers to contact all of us. Sent that as a physical hard copy and a scanned copy by email. They didn't even reply. They didn't reply to the emails. They didn't reply to the letters. I finally followed up and physically called. And that's an expensive call from Alberta to India. And the officer who answered said, yes, we received your complaint, but we cannot file it unless you appear here physically to sign the paperwork. And my lawyer told me that's absolutely not true. In international law, if you have a signed affidavit by a lawyer and you include a copy of your passport, that's all they need. And then later it was revealed to me by a friend who left that Ma Achala Swami, who heads the legal team, was tipped off. The police called her lawyer and said, Sarah Landry is trying to file an FIR for sexual abuse and child beatings. And she handled it. So either paid the police or something. I can't speculate, but she put an end to my case.
Right.
And
something fishy happened.
Very fishy. And I mean, there was a young man from Tamil Nadu who went to the station in Ramanagara or Bidadi. I don't want to mix up the two, but I think it was the Bidadi police station. He went to file a complaint against Nityananda. They told him to wait. And then goons from the ashram showed up and beat the shit out of him. So why am I going to trust them when they tell me I have to appear physically at their station when I know that this has happened to somebody else who went there to file a complaint?
Obviously, I mean, you're in danger. I mean, and that could have been what they were planning for you. I mean, wow.
I'm sure it was a trap. I'm sure it was a trap. And like when they first started their Facebook accusations against me, they accused me of sexually assaulting someone named Sundareshwara, who's one of the goons of the ashram. They accused me of assaulting a girl named Priyamaya, who was one of his personal service team. And I was afraid that, you know, the way they attacked Lenin and Arti Rao and Douglas McCallar and Vinay Bharadwaj and like the whistleblowers from 2010, nobody went public between 2010 when those four spoke up and 2019 when I spoke up. So there was a 9-year gap. He basically set an example that if you leave and speak up, this is what will happen to you. And so I didn't know how badly it was going to hit me. I thought it could be as bad as what he did to all of them. One of them served jail time, prison time. One of them wound up owing $500,000 in legal fees. One of them was horrendously abused by his wife, who made all kinds of false accusations against him, who is still in the cult. So the first thing I did when they started making these accusations against me was go to my local police with copies of everything they're saying about me and ask, what should I do? And all they said was, none of this can ever harm you as long as you stay out of India.
Yeah.
So as soon as the Indian police are telling me come to India, I'm sure one of his disciples would have put a false case against me.
Mm-hmm.
That's just what they do. And that's why, like I told you, most of his followers are Indian. Some of us are Western. It's only the Western people speaking out. That's not because
they can get away.
Because we can do so safely. Yeah, we're not going to have goons showing up or false cases taken out against us.
Wow. That's gnarly, man. And, you know, this is just one of the, I mean, so thank you so much for coming on and telling the story. And thank you also for telling it again and again and again and again. Oh. I know you've done this a lot of times, but I mean, it's very, very important to get this message out there, because you know, something that I believe deeply is that there is a mass spiritual awakening happening, and that it's really cool. And, you know, and I love being a part of it, and I want to talk about it. That's why I started this podcast. I want to talk to people about it, because it's great. But this dark aspect of it is out there, and it is real. And Nithyananda is not the only active cult in the world today. There are many, many, many. Scientology is still like going strong. It's outrageous. Yeah. And, you know, so I wanted to say another thing, that just another red flag, and this is for me personally, and I know everyone's a little bit different on this one, but I don't believe in any particular symbolic truth. One of the teachings of chaos magic, which is the branch of metaphysics I'm involved in, is that nothing is true, everything is permitted. And I think that that statement really saved me in a lot of ways from falling into one of these belief traps, because belief is so powerful. People who don't have much of a spiritual connection might not realize how powerful their beliefs are and how controlling their beliefs are of their lives. Once your beliefs get warped in a certain way, you can be made to do anything. If you believe, really believe in what you're doing, that it's for some great reason or some, you know, cosmic reason, even, you know, you can, I mean, obviously people can be molded to do anything, and that is terrifying. So you really got to keep your wits about you in the spiritual space. And hopefully, you know, I don't want this to scare anyone away, because this is a beautiful, powerful thing that you can be involved in, but it has to be for you and not for anyone else. And don't ever let anyone else tell you what to believe or tell you what the truth is. You have to figure that out for yourself. And that is, in my opinion, the spiritual journey, is figuring out for yourself what you believe to be true. And, you know, and the way I see it, I'm kind of weird, but you have to figure out for yourself what you believe to be true and know that you're wrong at the same time, and continue to believe and evolve and get somewhere with it. And there is no one out there has the full, absolute, unequivocal, metaphysical truth about the spirit realm or the gods and gods or the universe. Nobody, no scientist, no billionaire, no guru, no one has that. And it's the beautiful thing about life is that we get to decide for ourselves about that. Even though there is a tremendous amount to explore, that, like I said, I firmly believe in astrology, numerology, tarot. I believe that there are metaphysical, essentially like mechanical, metaphysical workings underneath that we can look at, but it isn't necessarily attached to any particular morality or set of symbols or pantheon of gods or way of living. You know, that stuff is all individual.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I like to think of it as if, like, there are more than 7 billion people on this planet, and to each, life is something completely different. So how could there be any one truth when every single person experiences reality differently?
Mm-hmm.
And in that sense, we are each the center of our own universe. And so determining our own beliefs for ourselves will always be infinitely more powerful than having them dictated by somebody else, even if it's somebody well-intentioned.
Yes. Yeah. So. Thoroughly. You know, that brings up another good point. So on Facebook, I'm part of like a couple of Bashar groups, and some of them are absolutely ridiculous. Some of them I'm like, you guys are following him way too hard. Like it's too much. He wouldn't want that. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But people, there's this need people have to feel like they know a secret, or a truth. Like, oh, I know, you don't know, but I know. You know, that's so appealing, but it's appealing to your ego. And don't get me wrong, I'm not one of those people who's like, ego is bad. No, ego is an important part of you that you need to master and integrate. Mm-hmm. And that's another one of the spiritual teachings. That's another one of these traps, is that there's people out there who have these giant inflated egos telling you that your ego is something you need to get rid of.
Yeah, true.
Don't listen to those people.
No. Like one of the other things that Fraud tells his followers is that you can never exaggerate his greatness, because even if you make up the most ridiculous exaggeration of how great he is, he's even greater than that.
See, and that's just nuts.
I know. And just, he'll tell us for ourselves, don't ever boast, brag, or take credit for your achievements. It's all a gift from him. So he wants to completely obliterate any sense of pride we might take in our accomplishments. He wants to take credit for. And when it comes to his accomplishments, he's not even feigning to be humble. He's obviously arrogant and obviously grandiose. But I was talking to a friend yesterday who has had experiences with this Fraud that were very damaging to that person's life. And they told me that he always told us you can never exaggerate his greatness, but the more we all start talking to each other and sharing abuse stories, we're coming to realize we can never exaggerate his terribleness. Like just when you think he's a rapist, he's a racketeer, he's, you know, abused men and women, then you find out that he was also abusing children. And you find out he made all the kids beat each other. Then you later find out he also beat some of them. And it's like, as bad as you think he is, he's worse. And these are the people who tell you not to have an ego and claim to be great. Like there's always something sinister under the surface of somebody who tries to take away your self-sovereignty.
Anybody who tries to take away your sovereignty, tries to diminish you in any way, because spirituality to me is about realizing how powerful you are and how you are the center of your own creation, and that, you know, all of these, that you are powerful, you know, that you're magic. That's what it did for me. You know, that I love that, but you must balance that with humility. And if you don't realize that you must balance that with humility, then like, oh man, I'm very lucky. I feel very fortunate to have not gone off the deep end, because I totally see how possible it is. You know, like I said, that E.A. Kwedding dude telling people that he's a living God and that he can teach you to be a living God. It's just like absolute nonsense. Like what this can teach you to do is know yourself a little better, to not succumb to nihilism, and to believe in something that's fun and lets your mind wander and explore the possibilities of this crazy existence that we know almost nothing about, but not to be beaten down into submission and formed into this thing you think will please a person or a deity. Like no person worth doing that for would ever ask that of you.
Exactly. Yeah.
No.
Yeah. It's just like if somebody actually does levitate, they will be so blissed out in their levitation that they're not going to come down to tell everybody about it, because they don't need that external validation. And anybody who's actually mastered that would have some form of divine connection that lets them know this isn't the goal. It's just one branch or one petal of that flower. It's not, you can't seek anything from the context of just having one aspect of that. Like, you can't eat a balanced diet if all you eat are strawberries. You know, you can't have a healthy relationship with somebody if the only way you connect is through joking. Like, that might be one good thing, but it's not the be all and end all. And so somebody telling you, you know, you can be a living God. Okay, great, be that, but that's not the only thing to strive for. And that doesn't mean that you aren't already that. We are all already that.
We are all already the, you know, the way I put it is fractals of God.
Exactly.
You know, yeah.
Fractals is a great way to put it. Yeah.
And that, you know, because we are consciousness. And again, my personal belief is that consciousness is the baseline substance of the universe, and that we are living consciousness. We're an embodiment of consciousness. And that's a beautiful concept, right? If you want to name it or break it down into pantheons of gods, that's totally cool too. Those are individual decisions, whatever works for you, it's all good, right? But it's got to be like, you know, in Christianity, they talk about having a personal connection to Jesus. Sure.
Yeah.
I get that. Have a personal connection to the universe in whichever way works best for you. All this worship stuff, it's, you know, it's outrageous. I understand why it's appealing, but it's so toxic. And it really does make me sad to see it happening to people, because I know that they're after something beautiful and they're getting fed shit.
Exactly. You know,
in search of something beautiful.
I still believe in the Hindu pantheon. I still, like, Mahakali, I take her as my Ishta Devata, and I still believe in Shiva. But my belief in them is such that they don't need my belief to be what they are. It doesn't matter whether you believe or not, whether you worship or not. They're that. The sun is going to rise in the east, whether you believe it or not. You don't need to worship it to make it rise. It's just there. And, you know, that. Anybody who tells you have to do some formulaic thing to connect with that energy is trying to get something from you. They're trying to get something.
I agree. And, you know, I think that when, especially the more I grow along this path, the more I start to see that a lot of these so-called, you know, ancient teachings from 100 to 200 years ago, so many of these people were trying to start cults. Aleister Crowley, who I, you know, I think he's done a lot of good work, and I think a lot of his work is bad. I have very mixed feelings. Same with Manly P. Hall. I think a lot of his work is very interesting, and a lot of it is cultural appropriation to such an extreme that it needs to be recognized for what it is. Same thing with Helena Blavatsky. Cultural appropriation to an extreme, an extreme, you know, and they haven't, it's weird how the like a cult community doesn't recognize that so much. Because, and that's not to say, like, I believe that cultural exchange is a beautiful thing. I'm not one of those people who say, you can't do that. But when you steal from a culture, whitewash it, and then sell it for millions of dollars, now you're doing something really fucked up. That's cultural appropriation. Especially when you demonize, this is what Manly P. Hall and Blavatsky did, when you demonize the culture you stole from.
Right.
Oh, you know, all of these things are so terrible and unnecessary along the spiritual path. Terrible and unnecessary and weird. You do you, all of you out there, you do you. Do whatever makes you, like, feel connected to some sort of spirituality in any way, shape, or form that works for you. Okay, so one last thing I want to get back to when it comes to the superpowers thing is, let's say that you could levitate and walk on water. So what? Who cares? What are you going to do? What useful thing can you do with that? About showing off. It's about
your ego again. You can probably get a Las Vegas show.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. Okay, cool. Yeah. You know, entertain people. But it's not worth anything to your spiritual advancement. It's not, you're not becoming a better person by floating in the air, holding your hands in a mudra, you know, and looking cool. It's a photo op is what you're going for. You're not going for enlightenment. You're going for a photo op.
Yeah.
Come on. Right.
Exactly. And I really think the only reason the fraud who calls himself Nityananda promotes himself as being able to give people superpowers is that he knows that's very appealing to a lot of people who are not actually spiritual seekers. They're experience seekers, and they want bragging rights. They want that photo walk.
Yes.
They want to be able to hold something over other people. And they also if they can demonstrate something like that accurately or in a way that convinces other people is
right,
real.
Like the pearl in the banana.
Yeah.
Oh,
I know.
So cheesy. So corny. Very cheesy.
And then they'll say, now you can never question my guru because you know this is possible. It came from him. And that makes me really mad because he would have me demonstrate things like remote viewing and body scanning and convinced me that I had those abilities from him, even though that was already happening in tarot readings before I ever knew him.
Right, because those are the psychic abilities that we can really develop.
Yes.
I don't have the ability to do a body scan. I do have the ability to see a person's aura and see if there's holes in it. I do have the ability to remote view a little bit. I'm not good at it yet. I do target practice. These are skills you have to develop. Your third eye is a muscle and you have to flex it. You have to exercise it. And I'm not saying, I'm not saying that it is absolutely impossible that you could develop yourself to such a degree that maybe you float for a second. Okay, cool. Whatever. I'm saying I wouldn't give a crap if it happened to me because the ability to read tarot cards is more valuable to me than anything I ever learned in my life. I mean, and the ability to look at my astrological chart and say, okay, I know why I feel the way I do today. I can see kind of what's going on and maybe I can calm myself down. Like I'm having an extremely emotional day and I see that the moon is in Pisces. I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. This is going to pass. I'm going to be all right. It's just going to be an emotional day. I don't have to explode. Right.
Right.
Those are the things. It's just those little things that are life-changing to me.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And those are the things that are available to everybody and you don't have to pay for them other than if you buy a tarot deck, like that's it. Or, and they're not bestowed upon you from anybody else because you know this. And I think any legitimate spiritual practitioner knows this. What you do determines what you will be able to do. And even if you master tarot or astrology to the level of master, you can't just touch somebody on the head and now they're a master too. They have to put in the study. They have to put in the practice. They have to do the meditations. They have to learn the symbology or tune into the channeled wisdom. You can't just magically gift everything you have to somebody else.
And no, it's a lot of work.
And that's the big deception of Nitti is that he would make us sit in a hall for sometimes 12 hours straight, no bathroom breaks, no food, no water. We would sit and be told for the next 7 minutes, grab a random partner and do a remote viewing for each other. Write everything down. Don't say anything out loud. At the end of the 7 minutes, you give the other person the paper. They tell you what's right, what's wrong, and why. Then switch, next partner, next partner, next partner. We would do this every day for weeks. And at the end of that, some of us would be demo ready, meaning we could sit on stage and do remote viewings for whoever came in from the public who wanted them. And he would tell us, it's all because of my touch. I touched your third eye, therefore you have this. Whereas in reality, it's because we sat for hours on end, for weeks on end, every single day doing nothing else but that. We worked out that muscle.
And having you do that, he also got to figure out who was really sensitive and who's not. Who can I pick? Who are going to be, who's really psychic in this group or like has exercised that muscle enough? And now I'm going to use you.
Yeah. And that's how I wound up as one of the people on stage doing the demos. I was one of those people. A lot of the Gurukul kids were among that group. The Gurukul kids who were not able to do that were horrendously abused and mistreated and made to feel less than. And there was also a spiritual hierarchy within his cult where those of us who, quote, manifested Shaktis would get to wear what he called the Trinetra Tilak, which was like a flame-shaped bindi. And everyone else had to wear a circular shaped bindi. And the flame meant we could see through delusion. And there was a whole thing where everyone aspires to that. And so what I know as a spiritual fact, even though, like you said, nothing is real, but everything is real. What I believe is the worse you feel about yourself and the more you feel like you can't do it, the less you'll be able to do it.
And absolutely. Because it's a belief. Your belief is changing about your own abilities. The first step to opening your inner eye is to believe that you can.
Exactly. And so on one level, he's telling everyone you can, but on another level, he's making everyone who doesn't have it yet feel like shit about themselves and punishing the kids. Like when the kids told me they got beaten on December 31st, the reason they were beaten is as horrific as the actual physical violence. At that time, there was a program going on called Maha Sadashivoham. Over 900 participants were there. They had all paid $15,000 to be there for 30 days. And the entire purpose of that program was to open the third eye to manifest these powers. And every day, the Gurukul kids, children aged 7 to 18, were brought into the hall. They had to sit with participants the way I described, like you partner up with one person, you do a remote vision for each other, then you do body scans for each other, then you make their hair grow by 1 inch, or you make them move an object with the third eye, like telekinesis. There were multiple things people were supposed to experience being cycled. And the feedback was not good. Like participants started to complain. We were told we'd get this within a day. The first time he touches us, I haven't experienced anything yet. He blamed that on the kids. Oh. And so the Gurukul teacher went into their dorm. She yelled at them and said, "This program is a failure because of you. If you actually had devotion, if you actually had trust in Swamiji, you would have entangled with these participants. Their neurons would mirror your neurons and they would be manifesting the powers. So you don't love him enough. You don't care about him enough. You're not authentic. You're a bunch of frauds. You're a bunch of liars. Beat each other to break that negative pattern." And so it was a physical violence. It was also a deep emotional abuse that they were enduring. And, you know, some of the kids had bruises and welts and visible cuts. So they were locked up until it healed. And we didn't see them again for the rest of that program. And what we, the adults, were told is that they are doing completion. But what they were actually doing was healing from the violence. So it's just so multi-layered. And this is the kind of psychopath who can't admit his own faults. He couldn't admit that he lied to people and made false promises and can't actually awaken these powers through a touch. He had to blame it on something, and he blamed it on the kids. And that's the most messed up thing. He blamed it on the kids. So people who attended that program essentially paid $15,000 in order for kids to be abused because of them. And that's something that I'm not saying that to put blame on them. It's not their fault. They were swindled and the kids were abused. And the only person who benefited from it was that fraud who ran away with all the money in the end, fled India, escaped a rape case. He's now staying in luxury villas. The demands he makes on his inner circle people, he needs a bedroom with an ocean view. He needs all of his jewelry with him. He needs all of his fancy clothes and sex slaves and everything. Whereas all he does, he just abuses people, sucks up their money, sucks up their attention, sucks up their praise. And I just can't believe he won't wind up in prison. Like Rainier.
Oh, I believe he will. I believe he will.
Thank you.
I hope that he does soon.
Me too.
As soon as possible, because this shit is dangerous. And these people are like really, you know, working against the spiritual awakening that's happening in the world now. They're trying to shut it down because they're trying to, because once somebody goes to experience, let's say you paid $6,000 or $10,000 to have somebody touch you and you're supposed to all of a sudden have superpowers. Like, okay, let's not even get into how ridiculous that sounds in the beginning, but once you realize it, it's bullshit, you're going to fly home, be like, it's all bullshit. And you're going to go right back to atheistic nihilism, right? Absolutely. Right back to those really, you know, those belief systems that I personally don't advocate for anyone. I know that there are a lot of people out there who are atheists who believe that that is the way for them. And I respect that, but I believe that the atheism and nihilism are at the core of so much mental illness and depression and anxiety.
Nihilism, for sure. I think atheism, it's a sliding scale. Like, and some
it people, is because I can't even define that word exactly, right? Because it's weird. Like, there is so much scientific evidence for what we could call a spirit realm. You don't even have to use those words. If you're uncomfortable with the words like spirit and God, that's cool. I'm kind of uncomfortable with myself. I like the term the universe. I like to talk about the advances in quantum physics and like theories of consciousness. Yeah. And I know they're a little bit out there. I'm cool with that though. If it's not for you, it's not for you. That's fine. You know, but these things have helped me to agree that I cannot help but want to spread it around again in a non-preachy way, hoping that other people can kind of like just feel a little bit better about life and about themselves.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And you're right. It's these individuals who claim to be spiritual, but really they're just very toxically materialistic that ruin spirituality for anyone who goes to them and gets disillusioned. And that is also happening on smaller scales. There are people who are not cult leaders, but who have cultic tendencies, who abuse people like that. And I hear from a lot of people who comment on my videos when I interview other survivors of the Nityananda cult. For example, one girl who reached out was in a Christian cult that was doing similar things, mm-hmm. you know, Pentecostal, speaking in tongues, dancing with the spirit, and all geared towards worshiping one particular pastor. And she recognized the same pattern. Somebody who was in kind of an Egyptian cult where the leader would tell them, you know, who is the Egyptian god to whom they're the most connected. And it doesn't matter whether or not you even like that particular god. Now that's who you have to identify with. And it's like anytime somebody claims to know you better than you know yourself, that person is a liar. Nobody knows you better than you know yourself, unless you're 2 years old and it's your mom and dad. Like, there's no...
I will say to that, it's been my experience that a truly studied, and I'm not going to say gifted because it's not about gifted, it's about study. A truly practiced and studied astrologer can probably tell you things about yourself that will knock your socks off, in my opinion, right? And if you don't believe me, that's fine. You know, but it's not that they just, I'm going to tell you about you. It's like, no, I'm going to tell you about your chart. I'm going to tell you what I see in your chart based on the time you were born. And if it happens to be insanely accurate, as it often does, you know.
And it's usually a confirmation of something you already knew.
Yes, yes. And also with tarot. Tarot does not ever tell you anything that you don't already know. Exactly. It just tells you the thing you know, but you don't want to know. Yes. You know that you know it, but you don't want to know it. And the cards are like, no, you have to know this.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right, Sarah, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for tonight. I think we're going to have to do part two because there's a lot more to talk about in this. There's a lot more to get into. Thank you so much for coming on the show. It's important to me to help spread your message.
Thank